Governor Scott Walker got a firsthand look at the Superior Oil Refinery yesterday after explosions and a massive fire rocked the plant on Thursday. Husky Energy of Canada purchased the refinery from Calumet Specialty Products last year. It has a capacity for 50,000 barrels a day. Refinery manager Colin Shady said at a press conference he wasn't sure how long it would be before the refinery is back in operation, as investigators have to collect evidence to determine the cause.
Once they're satisfied that they have the evidence and the information needed to make a proper assessment of what actually happened, then we will be allowed to start cleaning the area up and going to work, you know, repairing what's damaged.
Let's get an update from Danielle Kading, who has been covering every development on this. She is WPR's reporter based in Superior. Danny, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Kate.
What did we learn from the governor being on the scene there yesterday at the refinery?
Well, the governor talked mostly about how well everyone worked together during the evacuation in response to the fire. He commended all of the state, local, federal, and company officials that really worked together to fight the fire and make sure that everybody was evacuated safely, and hailed them, you know, that there was no loss of life. One of the things that he says, you know, you can clean everything up, you can put everything back together, but you can't bring people back. So he focused a lot on the response, but then he also talked about how state and federal agencies are working together now to look at air and water quality monitoring and how that's being done to make sure that it's done in the right way, to control surface water or runoff issues from any of the product or firefighting foam that left the refinery as they were trying to fight the fire, making sure that that's collected and cleaned up. And then that's sort of where things are at right now, and making sure that as they move forward in the process to clean up and repair things and rebuild, that they're looking at how they go about that.
So how is this investigation proceeding? Who is there on the ground investigating the fire, the incident?
The Occupational Safety and Hazard Administration, or OSHA, is there. They're investigating things related to worker safety to make sure that, you know, all the proper procedures were followed, or, and that they had safety programs in place and were following all the regulations. So they're examining that. And then the Chemical Safety Board has a four-person team there that is looking at things like chemical accidents and regulations, industry standards and safety. And I believe there was an individual who had worked on the plant in Cambria. You know, that report just came out yesterday. So they were traveling from Madison to Superior last night to get a briefing where things were at with that investigation.
So remind us to Cambria, remind us what that incident was about.
And that was the plant where it looks like corn or dust caught fire, mm-hmm. and caused the death of workers in Cambria.
So how has Husky Energy responded to this point?
Well, Husky Energy has said that they are going to do everything possible to make things right, to find out what exactly happened. They want to work with the community as a team to make sure that, you know, they're looking out not only for their workers who, you know, are still being paid during this point, but also for the community as they move forward and make changes at the refinery.
Talking with Danielle Kading, she's WPR's reporter based in Superior. We're getting an update on the situation at the oil refinery there, following it as federal investigators, state investigators are doing their work trying to figure out what was the source of the explosions and fires that rocked the oil refinery last Thursday. Danny, there is a lot of concern in the community, as you have found, about air quality and other issues. What are people weighing when it comes to the work that is being done at the refinery?
Well, one of the concerns that's come out what was related to why the evacuation was called, and that was because of a tank on site that contains hydrogen fluoride, which is used in the alkylation process at the refinery to make high-octane gasoline. And they had a tank that had 15,000 pounds of this chemical at the time. Usually there's around 75,000 pounds of this chemical at the refinery. So they base the evacuation order on how much chemical was there, because once it's released, it can have really toxic and potentially fatal impacts to people if it's breathed in or comes into contact with skin. I talked with a researcher or a retired scientist who spent his scientific career studying releases of chemicals like fluoride, hydrogen fluoride, and he said that it's really toxic. It destroys tissue in horrible ways. It can eat through it and go down to the bone, destroying all the tissue in between. And then if it's inhaled, it goes up into the sky as a cloud if it's released. And then if it's inhaled, it can cause lung damage because it attacks mucous membranes. So it's a very toxic chemical. But, you know, the refining process, there are a lot of toxic chemicals or hazardous substances that are used at oil refineries. So he said that this was just one of the most dangerous. And now there's questions being asked as to whether the refinery could switch to some sort of alternative to hydrogen fluoride that wouldn't have the potential to have such devastating health effects if it were released into the community.
Is the use of hydrogen fluoride common among refineries?
Well, right now it looks like about one third of the 148 refineries across the nation use hydrogen fluoride. So two thirds of the refineries nationwide are using some sort of alternative, and that may be sulfuric acid or other choices. So there are other options out there that the refinery could examine. And the refinery manager, Colin Shady, says that when he was asked about that, if they would consider switching yesterday, that they are exploring all kinds of options for how their refinery is configured or structured. But right now their priority is the investigation, but they will definitely look at different technologies out there and are constantly looking at that.
How does the community and how do city officials feel about the response so far?
I think the community and city officials feel that the response went very, very well, that everyone worked together as a team. And Superior Mayor Jim Payne said that they started this whole response as a team and they plan to go through the rest of the process that way to make sure that the community comes out better, that the refinery comes out better, and that they can improve the economy, public safety, and public health moving forward.
And what is the role of Husky Energy in Superior? Is it a staple in the community? Do people know it? How many people work there?
Certainly everybody's aware of the role that the refinery plays in the community, as well as other industry like Enbridge. You know, Superior has a lot of industry and that workers rely on. The refinery employs 181 workers, so it's a significant employer in the city. And it's been there for the last 60 years. You know, the refinery was built in 1951. It was there owned by Murphy Oil for most of the time until it was sold to Calumet, and now it's under the ownership of Husky Energy. And Colin Shady, the refinery manager, and both the Governor Walker said that, you know, the company remains committed to the community. And Governor Walker said that, you know, not only is the company committed to the community, but maybe look at even expanding in the future. And just looking at different ways to make sure that things like this don't happen again.
Do we have any sense on the timeline for the investigation as it proceeds?
Well, as far as OSHA's investigation, that needs to wrap up within the next 6 months, as far as whether everything was followed, as far as worker safety regulations. As far as the Chemical Safety Board, it looks like that process could take two or three times as long. You know, we might find out some preliminary results in the meantime, but a final wrap-up of their investigations will definitely take months.
Well, Danny, thank you so much for your reporting and making time for us.
Thanks, Kate.
Danielle Kading is WPR's reporter based in Superior. We've been getting updated on the situation at Husky Energy following it as federal investigators are doing their work in figuring out the source of the explosions, the fires that rocked Superior last week. Coming up, we'll talk with the head of Union of Concerned Scientists about worker protections and OSHA. That conversation is coming up after a news update here on the Ideas Network. Stay with us. With investigations underway now on the Superior Refinery explosions and fire from last week, it seems appropriate to take a closer look at OSHA and the regulatory aspect of workplace safety. Congress enacted the Occupational Safety and Health Act of 1970. Our next guest says, fast forward almost a half century and numerous studies find significant underreporting of workplace injuries and illnesses. Kathleen Rest is the executive director of the Union of Concerned Scientists. She's a former acting director of the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health. That's the federal agency responsible for conducting research and making recommendations for the prevention of work-related injury and illness. She recently wrote a blog post where we found her in Scientific American. It's titled, "The Health and Safety of America's Workers is at Risk." Kathleen, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kate. Thank you for having me.
Well, before we broadly look at occupational safety in the U.S., let's zero in and consider refineries for a moment, given the explosions and fire at the Wisconsin refinery late last week. What are the challenges, the concerns for refineries and businesses like them when workers are working with these chemicals?
Well, Kate, we have, I think, about 140 petroleum refineries operating in the United States right now. And I think we all know that these refineries and other facilities that use and process very hazardous chemicals are dangerous places to work. So a challenge is basically to understand that we, the workers that are there, the communities that are living in the area, are potentially exposed or being exposed to highly hazardous chemicals that pose serious risks. Now, some of these refineries are located very close to communities, as you well know, close to schools, close to playgrounds, and should a disaster or an emergency occur there, there is serious risk not only to the workers that are in the plant, to the responders that are coming to try to rescue the people there, but also the people in the neighboring communities. So location is also an issue. And I guess the concern is that we need to make sure that the workers in the plant, the people in the community, the emergency responders have the information that they need in order to respond successfully to a chemical disaster that may happen. And I fear that we're not quite there.
Well, this past weekend marked Workers' Memorial Day. You were writing around this day. What is recognized on that day?
Well, this is a day every year, April 28th, that's recognized as Worker Memorial Day, not just in the United States, but in many countries around the world. And it's a day where people are asked to pause and remember people that have lost their lives at work, become sickened at work, or seriously injured at work, but also a time to sort of renew commitment to the importance of worker health and safety protections. So it's a day, and I try to write about this every year, a day to just pause and think about the fact that our loved ones go off to work every morning. Some of them don't come home at night. Believe it or not, in the United States, we have an average of about 14 workers that are killed on the job every day. There are many more that are injured. There are many more that suffer occupationally related diseases. So it's a day to pause, reflect, remember, and renew the call for strong protections.
So that 14 people dying a day at work, has that remained pretty constant over the decades, or as you've watched this trend?
Well, here's the good news. 14 is not a good number. I think we can all agree that we would like that number to go down. But the good news is that since the early 70s, when our Congress decided to pass occupational safety and health legislation and create the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, it's really gone down. I think back in the early 70s, there were about 38 workers that were killed on the job every day. So we've really seen some progress here. So we should celebrate the progress and recognize that it's through the efforts of workers and employers and unions and our health and safety agencies that we've made the progress that we have, and understanding that we still have a way to go.
How has workplace safety and how we view it changed over time?
Well, how has it changed over time? Well, we now have health and safety agencies, a federal agency that is charged with developing worker protective standards, that is responsible for enforcing those standards, for helping employers comply with those standards, with giving workers information that they need to know about the hazards and risks that they face on the job. We have a lot more research now on health and safety aspects of work. We also track work-related injuries and illness, which help us understand where we should focus efforts, where the risks still are. And I would also say that with a changing workplace, and changing conditions of work, we have new risks and new hazards that weren't right top of mind when the OSHA Act was passed back in the 1970s.
Like what might that be?
Well, for example, we have issues relating to workplace violence. I'm sure that was always there, but we see increasing amounts of this in places like hospitals, certainly our emergency responders, police forces. We see workplace violence in workplaces. This is an issue that is emerging, and I don't think it was there top of mind when it first was passed, the Occupational Safety and Health Act.
So, Kathleen Rest, what does this mean for the economy? Do we have any sense of what the economic cost is from workplace injuries and workplace deaths?
Well, we do. I mean, the costs are actually enormous. According to the National Safety Council, they estimated that in 2015, between fatal and non-fatal work injuries, it cost this country about $142 billion. The number of workdays lost because people are injured and having to stay home is enormous. But I think that those costs are underestimated because they relate basically to fatalities, deaths, and injuries on the job. What they don't reflect are the things that are more hidden from view, occupational diseases. And if we were to put those costs in there, the latest study says that we can expect an additional $46 billion to about another $46 billion that would be added to the costs of occupational injuries and illnesses. So the cost is enormous. And the people that bear that cost, it's basically injured workers and their families and the taxpaying public.
Kathleen Rust is executive director of the Union of Concerned Scientists. She's a former acting director of the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, having a conversation about workplace safety regulatory aspects here on The Morning Show. You can join in 800-642-1234. Have you or a loved one had an accident in the workplace? What caused it? How did it impact your life? What does your company do to keep you and your colleagues safe at work? Call in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Kathleen, you write that the true burden of occupational injury and illness is far higher than just the broader cost to the U.S. economy. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that the people and the individuals and the families that have incurred work-related injuries and illnesses kind of know what I mean. We're talking about the pain, the suffering, the disability, the loss of ability to enjoy life. That's the true burden of this, aside from the economic costs. Think about people that have lost a limb or an eye at work, or people that have actually been buried alive in a trench, or doused with molten metal and burned alive, or people who have fallen off of scaffolds because of lack of safety protections there. The horror of what has happened to those people and the horror that their loved ones face in understanding what has happened to those people, that's the true burden. People that can't catch a breath because of exposures to chemicals at work, watching your loved one struggle to breathe because of a workplace illness, a workplace exposure, that's the human cost, way beyond the economic costs.
Walk us through, if you will, what happens when a company is found to have violated a regulation or regulations, plural, regarding safety. What does that investigation look like? Who comes in and how does that work?
Well, we have regulatory agencies, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. We have a federal OSHA agency that covers workplaces in 29 states, and in the other states, they're covered by state OSHA programs. There are about 8 to 9 million workplaces in this country. We don't have very many inspectors. In fact, I think the federal OSHA has about 750 inspectors. States have maybe another 1,000. That's basically enough for every inspector to visit every workplace once every 159 years. That's incredible. So what happens if OSHA or the state OSHA goes in and does an inspection and finds a violation? They may, if it's a very serious immediate violation, they will ask the company to shut down that part of the plant and abate the hazard right then. They may write citations telling the company that they have to abate the hazard, fix the hazard, give them some time to do it. They may fine them. The fines are usually not enormous. And then the employer can dispute the charge. But hopefully not. We have a lot of really wonderful employers who care a lot about worker health and safety. And then we have some unscrupulous employers that don't put safety first. And then we have some that don't even know what the hazards are, especially in smaller workplaces.
Well, looking at, say, a website like Violation Tracker and looking at some of these fines and the cost of these fines, it may be $5,000 for a certain violation, or it could be $10,000, $100,000. There's quite a range. And so how do these fines come about in terms of what price you put on a violation?
Well, the OSHA inspectors will look and recommend a fine. The administrators at the agencies will take a look at it and see if that seems reasonable or unreasonable, not enough, too excessive. It's hard to know how to put a dollar figure on a violation that maybe didn't cause a serious injury yet, but could.
Mm. Let's go to Rich joining us from Wanakee. Hi, Rich.
Hi, good morning. This is a fascinating topic to me. I've been a project manager in the construction industry for 25 years, and I've seen the safety thing kind of take a couple of different directions. And now I just want to share about a little bit about a company, the company that I'm currently working for, and our approach. And I think it's interesting, and I like sharing it. You know, we believe that the people are the key to our success, that all job site accidents are preventable, that our attitudes and actions make a difference, and that we're in charge of our own attitudes. But at a higher level, as like management and a flag bearer for the company, it's our responsibility to send that message and give the people, the craft workers, make them feel as empowered about monitoring safety. It's an all-in responsibility, and the bottom line is we're not asking anybody to be safety Nazis. What we're doing, like how I have my conversations, if somebody's not wearing their safety glasses, I'll just simply say, you know, I want you to be able to go home and see your family tonight at dinner, you know, and in the old days, it was somebody slamming their fists down and screaming and hollering and putting on your safety glasses. I just think it has taken a long time to change the tough guy mentality in construction and get everybody to realize that it is all for the benefit. It is for the benefit of everybody. A safe job is a job that has better morale, better productivity, better quality. I can tell you from personal experience, if there is a devastating injury on a construction site, the site changes instantly. Morale is down. Nobody wants to be there.
Rich,
finger pointing is going on. This is a fascinating discussion.
Rich, thank you so much for your insights, your personal experience where you were. Kathleen Rest, what do you make of that?
Well, Rich, thank you for your comment and for sharing your experience. You said something really important that I think listeners should pay attention to, and that is that virtually all injuries, deaths, illnesses relating to work are preventable. We know this. We know how to do this. We can virtually prevent all of them in construction and in many of the other industries. I like your discussion about all in and that everyone bears some responsibility. The Occupational Safety and Health Act really placed primary responsibility for a safe workplace on the employer. And the way you talked about it, Rich, makes a lot of sense. That as an employer, if you're doing the right thing and you're providing the safety equipment, the personal protective equipment, the safety glasses so that someone doesn't lose an eye at work, and you see that your employee is not wearing them, two things I think need to happen. One, you need to ask, why is this? Why are people not wearing their protective glasses? Is there some reason? We don't have enough of them, or they've lost them. So, you know, a look about why something isn't happening. But then, as a manager with a management responsibility, saying, look, we provide this. You need to wear this. If you don't know how to wear them, we will train you.
And, Kathleen, we're going to stop right there for the news. In 2015, when Calumet Specialty Products owned the oil refinery in Superior, OSHA issued 4 citations to the refinery, 3 of them for serious violations involving flammable and combustible liquids, hazardous waste, operations and emergency response. The violations were settled, the problems resolved by the end of that year. We're talking about the role of OSHA and the loosening of workplace safety regulations here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Kathleen Rest is with us. She is Executive Director of Union of Concerned Scientists. She wrote the recent Scientific American blog post titled "The Health and Safety of America's Workers is at Risk." You can join in the conversation with your questions, your perspectives, your experiences on the factory floor or working in refineries, 800-642-1234. And employers, let us know, what do you do for occupational safety in the workplace? What questions do you have about workplace safety here in the U.S.? You can call in or email ideas at WPR.org. Kathleen, let's talk a little bit about the President Trump administration efforts to decrease, roll back federal regulations, which he says have been choking industry. Is there a negative impact to workplace safety? And what is the correlation there?
So we do hear a lot these days about job-killing regulations, burdensome regulations, regulations that are just simply red tape. I mean, I think what's important for us to remember is these regulations are actually worker protections that have been put into place to protect our nation's most precious resource, our working people. So when I hear about job-killing regulations, I twitch. Because what we're talking about here are health and safety protections that were hard-fought, long-won, put into place to address serious hazards. And so in many ways, these regulations don't kill jobs. They actually stop jobs from killing, injuring, and maiming workers. So when I hear regulation, I hear safeguard. I hear protection. I don't hear red tape, job-killing problems.
Matt in Wausau emailed and said, labor has been under a centuries-long assault from the right. Act 10 was an excellent example of putting management ahead of workers. Matt says unions have historically been advocates for workers, and the concerted effort by Republicans has lowered our wages and made our workplaces less safe. It's profits over people. Kathleen, what is the impact of labor unions in regards to safety?
Well, labor unions have been historically some of the strongest and most vocal and most effective advocates for workplace health and safety, and for other benefits to workers, like an 8-hour workday, a minimum wage, sick days. We can thank U.S. labor unions for some of those benefits and protections that we have. They've been strong and vocal advocates. And, you know, unions, union membership has plummeted. That's true. Unions are still in full force, are still out there advocating. We owe them a debt of gratitude for what we, many of us, take for granted when we walk into our workplaces in the morning.
Veronica in Janesville called in to say, businesses get advanced notice of OSHA visits, so they have time to, quote, fix problems. Nothing will really change under the current system, Veronica says. Is that the protocol there, advanced notice of OSHA visits?
Well, I don't think so. Sometimes OSHA will go into a workplace doing something called compliance assistance, which is not an inspection or an enforcement activity, in which case there probably is advance notice. We're coming in, perhaps you've asked us to come in, and we're there to help you look at what the issues are in your workplace and help you comply. In terms of going into a workplace, I believe that most inspectors, for an inspection, most go in unannounced. It's really those compliance assistance visits that are probably pre-planned.
Well, supporters of these regulatory cuts say that some of these regulations just increase paperwork, more red tape, cost money while doing really little at the end of the day to actually improve worker safety. What is your response to that?
Well, I guess my response is one person's red tape is another person's health and safety. Listen, I would not be arguing that there are regulations on the books that could be tightened up and reviewed. But what I would also say is that because we have strong regulations on many hazardous substances, take asbestos, for example, or benzene, or silica, or vinyl chloride, these are protective regulations. These are not red tape. These are standards that are put into place to protect people. So, yes, I will agree that there may be some regulations that we should take a look at, but in the main, regulations are not red tape. They're safeguards. They're protections.
Going back a little bit to what the caller had said, saying that all job site accidents are preventable, but yes. We are human after all. Are all job site accidents truly preventable?
I would say virtually all are preventable. We have many ways of preventing workplace injuries, illnesses, and fatalities, from engineering controls, from safer work practices, from personal protective equipment, from training, from exercising, doing exercises in the plant to be able to respond to an incident that's happening. So we know a lot about how to protect workers. We have health and safety programs in plants where workers and employers get together and walk through the plant and see what's happening or what's not happening. And if something is not happening, why it's not happening. Is it because the employers are sending mixed messages, like work faster, but at the same time, don't forget to work safer? Sometimes there are mixed messages. So I would say that we know a lot about how to prevent things.
Let's go to Kate in Manitowoc. Hi, Kate.
Hi, it's actually Jane, but that's okay.
Oh, I'm sorry, Jane.
That's okay. The thing I want to mention is that we need to remember that the largest employer in our country is our government. And when we think of that, we have to think of the military folks in that they go on to the job expecting issues with weapons fire and IEDs and things. But then you have the years and years of Agent Orange exposure that is killing our over 60 veterans like crazy. And then the Marines that were on Camp Lejeune, who from 53 to 87 had dry cleaning fluid being poured into their water table. OSHA wasn't required to go in and test because, after all, it was a government site. And now we have our young men and women that are coming home with all sorts of respiratory issues due to the burn pits of the oil fires. Sometimes our own government is our worst enemy.
Jane, thank you so much for the call. Kathleen, military are not immune from workplace hazards.
Certainly not. Any public sector worker, any public servant, like people in the military, people that work for city, state, county government, people that work for our federal government, that do actually the same kinds of jobs that people in the private sector do. And as Jane just said, sometimes even more dangerous jobs, they're not subject to occupational safety and health protections under the federal legislation. So you're right. Public sector workers, including the military, deserve that protection.
Kathleen, what would you like to see happen to address workplace safety on a policy level going forward?
Well, I guess what I would like to see is that we continue to support the worker health and safety protections that we have in place, that we resist any efforts to roll back or weaken protections that are in place. I would like to make sure that our agencies, both state and federal, have the resources and the staffing that they need in order to fulfill their mission. which was actually defined by the Congress back in 1970 to provide every working man and woman in this country a safe and healthy workplace. I would like to see the standard setting process in OSHA fixed. It takes far too long to put in a new OSHA standard. Many of the regulations that we have in place were put into place back in the 1960s. They need to be updated, but the process is basically broken. It takes a very long time. When we're able to get a new standard out, they're usually very good and very protective, but this needs attention. And I guess I would like to see, given that we were talking about the refinery explosion in Wisconsin, I'd like to point out that it's not just OSHA, right? We have the Environmental Protection Agency that has a chemical disaster rule, or also sometimes called a risk management rule, that is supposed to cover the most highly hazardous facilities in this country. It was updated a while ago, but the present administration has delayed implementation of that rule until 2019. The explosion in Wisconsin is just another example of why we need the EPA to step up now, not further delay this rule. It's been delayed for almost 14 months. There have been quite a number of incidents that have happened across the country in facilities that would be covered by that rule. So I would say one of the things that I would like to see is when the EPA announces, the new EPA announces this new rule and decides they are going to implement it, there will probably be a public comment period. And I think every one of us should think seriously about commenting on this rule, saying we need it, our communities need it, our workers need it, our emergency responders need it. No more delay.
Kathleen, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me, Kate.
Kathleen Rest is the executive director of the Union of Concerned Scientists, the nonprofit science advocacy organization. We started the hour talking with Danielle Kading, WPR's reporter in Superior, as the investigation into what went wrong at Husky Energy in the aftermath of the refinery blasts and fires last week. This hour of the morning show was produced by Brianne Chasso and Ideas Network director Cheryl Gasser. Michael Derringer provided technical direction. This is the Ideas Network.